Traditional economics measures the ways in which we spend our income, but doesn't attribute worth to the crucial human interactions that give our lives meaning. Claire Brown, an economics professor at UC Berkeley and a practicing Buddhist, has developed a holistic model, one based on the notion that quality of life should be measured by more than national income. Buddhist Economics is her new book and leads us to think mindfully as we go about our daily activities and offers a way to appreciate how our actions affect the well-being of those around us. The book is inspired by a popular course that she teaches at UC Berkeley, and it's a pleasure to welcome Claire Brown to the Roundtable this morning. Claire, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to join you, Joe, on Roundtable.
You are an economics professor at UC Berkeley, a practicing Buddhist. How did all of this come together for you?
This came together because I was teaching 800 students Econ 1, which is basically a free market approach. And then on the side, we'd say, well, we have a problem with inequality. Oh, my, we have a problem with sustainability. But those were just taught separately. And I'm thinking, you know, we need an integrated, holistic model. And I was out walking my dog, and I said, how would Buddha teach introductory economics? And so I started teaching an undergraduate course and then ended up writing my book.
When you have an idea like that, did the answer to that question of how would Buddha teach economics come easily to you, or did it come through great exploration and research of trying to figure out the answer to that question?
That's a great question, because at first, of course, it took enormous exploration. Starting off with Amartya Sen and his concept of capabilities and freedom helped a lot. So I started there, and he won a Nobel Prize for that work. And then the next thing I realized, I had to learn a lot about climate science and sustainability. We have faculty who know a lot about that, and they were all willing to help me. And then I realized, from a Buddhist perspective, we needed to look a lot more into suffering and sustainable development in poor countries. And Jeffrey Sachs and his work and the work at the UN were really great resources for me. It took me 5 years to pull it together.
Yeah, talk a little bit about those influences and why they were so important and how you were able to basically connect the dots.
You know, they actually do go together quite well once you start thinking, how do you integrate these?
Mm-hmm.
Because Amartya Sen takes a very holistic approach, except that about how do people live, how do you measure their quality of life. But he wasn't at a period where sustainability and global warming were a big issue. It was mainly a question of poverty and inequality. But the ecological economists have already been thinking a lot about how do we bring in sustainability in a system where the ecosystems can be threatened and we have boundary effects. So that's what I learned next, because some economists were just saying, oh, we can use cost-benefit analysis, everything's interchangeable. But in Buddhism, we're interconnected with nature, and you can't just act like nature is separate. But the ecological economists were already doing a lot of work, so I picked that up and integrated it. And then the Buddhism for me really came in, and how do you alleviate suffering? And that's where the UN, with their sustainable development goals, helped a lot, because they have done an enormous amount of work relieving starvation and extreme poverty and trying to figure out how to help people around the world that are in dire need. And so I brought in the UN Sustainable Development work.
You look at ultimately leading us to think mindfully as we go about our daily activities and letting us appreciate how our actions affect the welfare of those around us. How does that in practically and in actually putting that to work, what are the challenges in doing that?
I think the challenges are social norms in the U.S., especially for us, that we're already way too busy. We already have way much to do at work, taking care of family, helping friends. So we have this busyness that's driving us all the time. With every day, we're just chasing. You ask anyone, no one has enough time. But then you say, just a minute. In Buddhism, we learn to just stop, be still, and enjoy what's happening in our lives. And the minute you get people to stop and appreciate what's happening in their lives, they feel much better. They're much happier. But in Buddhism, we don't just say, be mindful and be aware to help just yourself. The whole idea is actually to be mindful of everyone around you and to help them in their own relieving of suffering and pain, as well as your own. So the mindfulness movement has helped a lot, but it needs to go beyond just helping yourself.
You know, if I read your book a year ago, I think I would have come out of it feeling as though we could make a change and that it was possible for us to go mindfully through our life and for us, as you said, as U.S. citizens, to work on these issues. Right now, I will admit that I read your book, and as I was reading your book of just saying, even feeling a little more helpless about things, because I hear nothing in our current leadership that gives us any sense that we are not only looking at these issues, but even thinking that they are important and really putting aside, I mean, not just how to tackle climate change, but whether it even exists.
Right. So one of the most important lessons, I think, in my book, which was written a year before the election, is that what we have to do is have a sangha, which is just our community. We all have plenty of communities when we stop to think about it. We have our neighbors, we have our churches, we have our Sierra Club. We have all kinds of communities that we share the same values with the people. So one of the things that my book says is that you absolutely have to work with your sangha or your community to reach out and demand the changes that we need to have an economy that creates meaningful lives and comfortable lives for everyone. And that was true even before the last election and the current problems that we're facing. So that what we say at the end of the book, I say, you know, you can leave mindfully, you can reduce your carbon footprint, you can do all those things and please do it, but then you absolutely have to join up with your community and your sangha and demand that we protect people and we protect the earth. And we will do that with every policy that is harming people, such as the immigration bans, such as rebuilding the pipelines, such as trying to withdraw us from the Paris Agreement. We must get out and we must actually rally and protest. And the Women's March was a great beginning.
I want to be as hopeful. You write in the book toward the end of the book, you have this whole thing about is working together on climate change, and we must be ready for the backlash from the wealthy fossil fuel energy companies. And there on page 169, you talk about Exxon and you talk about their scientists and having evidence of what this would do to the atmosphere and dangerous levels in the 70s. And now the guy that led that company is now in the highest position of power, one of the highest positions of power in our current administration. So how does that not like get to you to a point of saying, believe me, I want to have that Buddhist philosophy, but I also wonder how we put all of that into some sort of context and say, oh, okay, how do we deal with this right now, because there's the long approach and then there's what we have to do at this moment.
Right. I think the main word that I keep going back to is courage.
Okay.
That we need courage, and we need courage to actually fight against, as I say, big oil and fossil fuel. And now you're right. The Secretary of State was from Exxon. I'd had a little practice already because I live near a Chevron refinery plant. And we are continually having to deal with their air pollution that makes our children sick, as well as the global warming from carbon dioxide. And so, and they fight hard. But of course, it's nothing like what's happening today. So you can't have courage just by yourself. That's once again where you really do need to be in a group. And that's when things get really, really bad. Like last night I went and met with my small greener Sangha group, and that helped enormously because we talk about where in Buddhism and in Buddhist economics, in the long run you have to have hope. And you can do things at the local level, at least in California and where you live, in New England, but there's some places where it's much harder for people to accomplish things at the local level, and we need to reach out to them also, the Trump supporters in the Rust Belt. We need to think, how can we help them understand how they could do better and relieve suffering without going to becoming a nationalist or put America first? So that I think we have to think holistically. And we have to remain hopeful. I'm an optimist, Joe, which really, really helps.
and I identify with that. I identify as an optimist, and I want to be optimistic. What I find interesting, though, and I guess you get mixed signals sometimes from the rest of the world, and I think mostly about climate change as we talk about this particular issue, is that we seem to be in some ways moving away from the rest of the world on this, and the concern is that as we do it, others will move away as well.
Yes, that is a big concern, although Europe is much more solid about it, and China has actually said they're willing to take the lead if the U.S. wants to try and move away. But the U.S. has a lot going for it, even if you dig beneath the Trump administration, that there is a lot going on in the private sector. And as the price of solar and wind and so forth come down, we need to do everything we can locally and at state levels to support clean energy and to help make it be spread. So I think there's things we can do. And at the international level, I think that it's important to continue to rally. We have that big climate mobilization rally coming up at the end of April. I think that's going to be very important because we have to both tell the world that Americans want clean energy and that we're willing to help fight for it.
When you spend time with your students and you teach them and you talk to them about Buddhist economics, I can only assume, and not to put words in your mouth, but I can only assume that that is a great source of the inspiration and the optimism that you have.
Oh, you know it most likely is. I just met with them yesterday for our class, and they say, well, we've never rallied before. We are really happy to learn how to rally and make our voices heard. We really want to study sustainability and integrating it into an economy that gives everyone a chance at a comfortable life. They are so upbeat and optimistic and energetic, and they come from all over the world. It's you're right, they are an inspiration. And so yesterday, one of the things I taught them how to do was to do a Buddhist prayer, which helps me a lot through the day. So Buddhism doesn't have a god. It just has the Buddha nature that's right in all of us. And so a Buddhist prayer starts with may you or may we. And so one of my favorite things to say is I'm walking around, and when I'm feeling especially a bit down, I say, may we heal the earth as we heal ourselves for the benefit of all. And that's basically the heart of Buddhist economics, is that healing earth, healing ourselves for everyone.
The name of the book is Buddhist Economics, An Enlightened Approach to the Dismal Science. It is published by Bloomsbury Press. Claire Brown, what a delight to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us and for offering courage and optimism.
It was wonderful discussing Buddhist economics with you, Joe.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Buddhist Economics. It's published by Bloomsbury. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.